finish out the opening verse, some opening verse. So.
I was okay. Thank you. Okay. Well, good evening. Well, it's so wonderful to meet you, and then, you know, I should put on my glasses. Because I recognize some of you from the Zoom. I'd like to say thank you to Kate and Michael for having me. This was rather a spontaneous trip that I made this time to visit my small community in Lethbridge in Edmonton, where I'm making a small sangha, a community. My name is Gyoke Yokoyama. Kate was saying, I currently live in LA, east of Los Angeles, in a city called Montebello, and I'm one of the 59, I believe 59 right now, Soto Shu appointed missionaries outside of, and specifically in North America. And such appointed teachers are in Europe, South America, and Hawaii, primarily serving Japanese American or Japanese communities. And it's been that way for the last 100 years, mostly. And during this last 100 years, by which I mean this year is the 100th anniversary, this mission started in 1922. And since then, all these different teachers came through Los Angeles, through San Francisco. Among such teachers were Shinryu Suzuki Roshi, Maizumi Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, Kobunchino Roshi, and all these teachers and their students formed what we see now as the North American Soto Zen. And it totally expanded beyond the ethnic communities of Japanese Americans and Japanese Canadians. And just last November, we had the 100th anniversary Jukai ceremony. And I believe this kind of thing happened after Buddhism reached Japan from China. Several hundred years later, Chinese teachers were invited, and where there were sort of a demonstration or some kind of a sharing of the tradition, just to kind of reconfirm the tradition back then. The Jukai, which some of you I believe must have done in your sangha, happens in each community. But in the original sense, there's a certain way to do Jukai. I often explain this to people who are Catholic. It's kind of like inviting the Pope to your own community. So it's a kind of a big deal. That's how it happened 20 years ago when they had an 80th anniversary. But this 100th anniversary, we wanted to do this just with the local American leaders. Of course, we had some support from Japan, but we had Reb Anderson, Shohoku Kumura, as a precept teachers, who would explain precepts, Enkyo Ohara from New York, Tejo Munich from Great Tree, Jisho Siebert from Zen Field, you know, Iowa. Three preceptors included Chozen Bays from Great Vow, Shoken Wanka from Ryumonji in Iowa. Then Akiba Roshi, who's been serving as a director for the last several decades, it was among the three preceptors. We made a kind of a agreement that this entire Jukai ceremony, that would be extended for 7 days originally, but we shrunk it in 5 days, would all happen in English. Sutra would be all chanted in English. Explanation would be all chanted in English. I work for the office as one of the two secretaries. My partner is Ezra McMullen of Great Buddha Eye Temple in Oregon. A great teacher. He coordinated this, and of course there are many people from Japan who supported this as an assistant. We only translated things that were said in Japanese into English, but not the other way around. So we made it pretty clear that here we are in North America after 100 years, we are practicing this, and this has become the North American thing. And we wanted to embody this tradition among the Zen teachers, leaders of North America. So that was successful. And I had one complaint about this, which was, I served for the North American office while serving the local community. And yet, we always said, where's the Mexico? Where's the Canadian sanghas? And especially Canada. I said, well, we really have to reach out and then sort of just to build ties and connections. And that was just my personal aspiration. As for my own personal connection with Canada, I was 16. I spent a year in Winnipeg. I got a frostbite with two fingers here. But I went out for a bike ride in January. So that's how I remember Canada. I have a son who's 10, who was born in Huntsville, it's called, a part of Ontario. He has Down syndrome, and so I come here often. My parenting is also part of my life. While I do the mission here in the U.S., in Los Angeles, his mom, unfortunately, we got divorced, but we are co-parenting my son together. So I have a lot of sort of affinity to Canada, and I've been making extra effort to try to explain why Canada is such a special place, but it seems like my Japanese friends and a lot of American teachers don't seem to be getting it. So, now, as we step over the threshold of the 100th anniversary, which we separated the celebration event from last November to this May, which is coming up, we are inviting the head priest from Sotoshu, Eheijin Sojiji, have representatives, especially Sojiji is sending the head priest, who is the current head priest of Sotoshu, and the president of our organization. We wanted to make sure that we are making this step over this threshold a meaningful event. And for our office to literally embody our mission across North America is an important thing to me, especially. I wanted to share a message. Where did it go? Yes, here. So I'll start officially. That's usually the way it goes, and I'll share something informal. This is one of the newspapers from the head priest. Current president, head priest of Sotoshu's name is Shuko Ishizuki, and he had a message. I'll just share a brief kind of a summary of his message, if you don't mind. There is a famous poet, Hakurakuten, and he has this question, the fundamental point or fundamental mind of Buddhism. And to that question, Rin Dorin Osho, so this monk answers, Shoaku maksa, shuzen bugyo, which is do not do, refrain from wrongdoings, and practice the good deeds. And of course, Hakurakuten responds, well, such a thing is something even a 3-year-old boy would know already. You might have heard of this already before. Then Rinda Osho says immediately, you can tell what's right, you can tell what's wrong, and even if you are 3-year-old. But to practice this is difficult, even if you're 80 years old. To know it and to practice this, there's a huge gap in between. And that's something Ishizuki Roshi was emphasizing as an important thing. And I think it's an important thing as we always practice, as we practice Soto Zen Buddhism. Jukae, as I said, was led by Akiba Roshi. He is the current director of the office. He's my boss. And I had an honor to translate for him. And there were actually 30 people who came forward to ask him questions. And I burned out this after this session. I didn't want to talk to anybody for at least 3 hours. But through this Jukai, he was emphasizing the importance of understanding Jukai precepts. Contemporary Soto Zen school sort of understands precept as such, and that is, we receive these precepts. You probably have, some of you must have read it, but it's right here if you're interested. But every single moment, we're breaking it. Most probably without understanding, without being conscious about it. Every single moment, every single speech, as long as we are living creatures, we're breaking it. Now, in this ultimate contradiction, how do we embody the Dharma? How do we practice these precepts? So that's the place you're kind of thrown into. So you don't just study, you don't just discuss about on this, but you practice. And according to Akiba Roshi's expression, you get kind of pickled and you start to have a little flavor. So that's the kind of Jukai. Another Roshi I want to kind of share is Shindo Aoyama Roshi of Sojiji Monastery. She's the first abbess, woman teacher, who became the director of the head temple, which never happened in history. Often criticized, we are a little patriarchal from the Western Zen teachers. But this Roshi, Shindo Aoyama Roshi, is a wonderful teacher. In this year's greeting, she shared quotes. She quoted the words from Kodo Sawaki. She was saying, when the charcoals are spread apart, eventually the heat kind of subsides. But then the charcoals are collected in one place. It maintains its heat. It generates more heat. Even has a power to burn down the whole house. Well, it's not a good example, but that's a comparison that we make to Dharma or Sangha. So that's how we understand the importance of the interconnection of the Sanghas. And finally, before I share my own message, I had an honor to translate, work as an interpreter for Hoitsu Suzuki Roshi. How many of you know Hoitsu Roshi? Okay. So Hoitsu Roshi, oh, thank you. Hoitsu Roshi. Oh, have you been to Hoitsu Roshi's temple?
To Jinso, okay. And anybody who went to
Jinso. Okay. Today. Oh, thank you. Good. Well, I haven't. I would like to go there. Oh, so Hoitsu Roshi was giving a Dharma talk for Sonoma Zen Mountain, Sonoma Mountains and Monastery. So my friend Nyoze asked me, he was looking for someone who could just ask for translation work. And I just happened to be available. So I met him on Zoom for the first time then. He is Shinju Suzuki Roshi's son. Yeah. Besides the message he conveyed during this Dharma talk, what was pretty remarkable was he shared his memory when Suzuki Roshi, you know, decided to leave for United States. Hoitsu Roshi was already, I think he had finished training. Maybe it was pretty big, and his father said to Hoitsu Roshi that I want to go to America to practice with the American people. And Hoitsu Roshi asked him, why do you have to do the zazen? Like, what's the point? What do you have? Why do you want to go to the United States to practice zazen? And Suzuki Roshi responded to him, and which part actually is the most important part? But I forgot. So if you have a chance, you can ask Hoitsu Roshi, if anybody knows. Now, I myself, after the practice of a Heijin monastery at age 20, as I came back, I needed some time to kind of keep slow it down, or maybe keep some distance, as I needed some time to digest what this practice was about. I went to a Jesuit school to study English, and this Catholic was practicing Zen. And that the way they were practicing Zen was to quiet your mind, let go of your notions, ideas. Then, only then, said only then, you get to hear what you need to hear. And it really intrigued me. And that's kind of how I came back to the practice of my own family tradition. After practicing at Aheiji, I'm pretty sure I was pretty annoying at the time. I was constantly asking, what is Dharma? What does it mean to sincerely practice? Where's the faith? And of course, I meant to be sincere. I meant to be committed. But I had all these ideas and notions about Zen practice. I already thought I knew what Zen practice was. Then I went to Aheiji, which was a huge mistake. When I came back, I was completely confused. So I didn't disrobe completely, but just needed to kind of have a regular life. So I stayed in Tokyo during those years after the practice. I worked as a translator, school teacher. During those years, Suzuki Roshi's book was one of the big support to help me realize that there's more than what I understood, which I think I intuitively knew, but couldn't quite put that into words. But Suzuki Roshi's book really helped me sort of look at the practice, the depth of the practice in a way I just couldn't with other teachers at the time. So I have a special sense, sort of an indebtedness to Suzuki Roshi's teachings, San Francisco lineage, branching streams, all these sanghas who are affiliated with San Francisco Zen Center. What I wanted to share today was that in Aheiji Temple, which I had such a mixed feeling for some time, there's a Tenzo who practice in the kitchen. How many of you, if you say Tenzo, does it mix finger? Okay, so Tenzo is a cook. Tenzo is a Zen cook. And then Dogen Zenji specifically read a book, Instructions of the Cook, to give guidance for how to cook. And we all know that when Dogen was such an intelligent, amazing student of Zen, went to China and met these Zen teachers who are senior Zen teachers who came down to the port to find a Japanese shiitake mushroom so that he could serve these mushrooms to fellow practitioners. Also, these teachers, senior monks, drying, I believe it's seaweed, right? Sometimes, yeah. You know, these are stories I hear, how when we learn about Zen practice isn't something that we understand what's here, but we embody through practice. It's part of like a textbook. Now, even for me, just recently, I went to Taiwanese temple in Montebello. Montebello is Alhambra. Those areas have a huge Chinese population and Taiwanese. So one of my friends, Taiwanese monk, invited me to this Taiwanese temple. And there was a feast of vegetarian meals. By the way, thank you very much for the feast. I was so full tonight. So I thought I might fall asleep during Zazen. This feast that I saw, and I asked them, like, so who's cooking this? There's a group of volunteers. And then they said, no, it's the abbot who made the entire meal. The entire meal. And the vice abbot was doing all the gardening work. And I have to admit, it was a huge culture shock. I thought I knew about this, being a Soto Zen monk. And then, you know, serving in North America, I totally forgot to see this Taiwanese Soto Zen monk actually doing it. Really blew my mind and kind of inspired me to do something. I have such a huge inferiority complex when it comes to cooking. I have this unreasonable belief that whatever I cook tastes terrible. But this experience made me realize that it is important. So I'm cooking. I'm cooking. Whatever I cook. Whatever I can cook. There's a certain way we need to cook that. And then I'm not going to explain that part. But today I wanted to share this flavors. Dogen Zenji talks about importance of harmonizing the balancing of these six flavors. And I often forget, but this one is bitterness, and the other one is sweetness, saltiness, sourness, and spicy. Yes, yes. And then the sixth one is there. And sixth one, unfortunately, is not a umami. it's awami. And I'm curious because, you know, Mike, you're translators too, how you would translate. I could only translate it as like faint, subtle flavor. It's a flavor that it's hard to notice. When you go there, meal tastes really good, really good. We chant the verse for the meal practice, and we receive this, the whole meal served by Tenzo. I used to think because in the monastery, since there's no entertainment, the food becomes so kind of a thing that we look forward to, and I used to believe that's why everything tastes so good. But when you have this sour flavor, bitterness, sweetness, saltiness, it's in such a harmony. It's amazing how it tastes. Simplest food you get served. And also when you go to the Eiheiji for Zuise, it's a special event when you complete a certain process. Or maybe as a special guest, they serve you a meal in such a fancy kind of a lacquered container or a plate. And then it's a really kind of beautiful dishes they serve. But what you see inside, it's just a shiitake mushroom, just a carrot. And they cook it separately to let that shiitake mushroom of carrots or vegetables produce its own flavor. That's the subtle flavor of its own original flavor. And when we eat respectfully. And we always, I'm not sure, I don't think this is just me or other than people around me, but in Soto Zen practice, this attitude we cultivate to the food or the practice of eating meals is compared to our own practice of Zazen. This is exactly the attitude we approach when you sit. This is exactly the attitude when we meet our Sangha members, when we bow. Only then you get to taste that flavor, the awami. In Soto Zen, in Japanese Soto Shu emphasizes patience. I think it's something all Buddhist schools emphasized, and yet sometimes overlooked. Patience, some other people say constancy, they use the word constancy. And to me, it's not, this kind of patience is not to kind of suppress your ego, suppress your kind of curiosity or you know, kill your sort of eagerness. It's this kind of patience. I share this with other folks that it's kind of like, it's not a good example again. I'm a terrible, I make a terrible example, but it's like a hunter waiting for, in this, I grew up in a rural community, so I met several hunters who does hunting. They wait in the mountain, sometimes several hours, sometimes days, and then they wait and wait until the mountain rivers decides to make its offering. And I often think of indigenous people in that sense. It's that kind of patience that's required. And that's the thing I was missing during those days I was practicing at Eheiji. I couldn't get it. I couldn't get it after the practice. I'm not sure if I still get it, but that's the guidance that I receive from all these teachers around. And we sometimes forget this point, and we get to hear this from other teachers. So that's why when sanghas, teachers are always around, there's a reinforcement, so we strengthen our understanding and practice. So I often present myself as the most mediocre teacher you can find, with the most mediocre understanding. And that I kind of find it's a very important thing. As I grew up in the most general common community temple, and yet, however, somebody like me who could still be exposed to these beautiful teachings and amazing teachers. I think what's happening in North America is amazing, respectable. On Sunday, I was listening to Kate's Dharma talk. Thank you very much. As we are celebrating the 100th anniversary, we just celebrated the new year, and now we are celebrating the arrival of spring season, especially in Canada. It's getting warm, right? Is it getting warm? No, okay, I'm sorry. All right. Okay, I came from Alberta, so I thought Vancouver is getting warmer here. We celebrate this. And I appreciate how you share your time and presence here. And yet, we know that there are thousands, millions of people out there suffering with pains, losses. Canada have this thing I've been paying close attention to, residential school. We talk about this a lot. Ukrainian and Turkey's. Hoetsu Roshi said this as his message when he shared the message at Sonoma. He used the word kafu. Kafu. I can only say this is a way of the house, way of the mountain. I don't know. Kafu. Kafu. Well, let me.
Wind of the house.
And
it's like the atmosphere.
Yes. Thank you. Kafu. Yes. Wind of the house. Way of the house. Yes. Each house, each community, each lineage has something like this. Well, Hoetsu Roshi said, when we face this, kafu is to live this day like the pure white snow, like the buds of the white plum in the cold, like the moonlight in the dark. And he said that's the kafu of, and that's how we practice zazen. So that was a message from Suzuki Roshi. He was a wonderful, wonderful teacher. Again, there's a subtle flavor there. And I hope you get to enjoy this awami of your practice. It takes a little patience. I grew up as the youngest in the family, so I'm often impatient. but when you practice, can you get to see this? So that's something I wanted to share. How are we doing time-wise? I don't want to...
We have a few minutes.
Okay.
If you are open to any questions people might have.
Okay. Sure. Thank you. Yes. Yes. If you have any questions...
Please raise your hand if you have a question you'd like to ask.
Yes.
I think you were saying previously that you were amazed to see what's happening in North America, and I was just wondering if you could elaborate on that, like something in particular that you just are very, you look forward to?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I hear some teachers talk about this, especially when they are building their sangha. You know, many first generations, first waves pioneers, they were out there, especially when I look at Canada, there are many great teachers in outpost dots. In the United States, some sanghas are maturing into a, you know, solid sangha. I think this sangha is the most vibrant, solid and vibrant community in Canada. As far as I could see, I could be missing something. As far as I could see, and then this gives us such a huge assurance and inspiration. But they talk about how do we continue this tradition next 500 years, next 500 years. Not just one generation, not just my time. It's not just this community's life. And that is the vision. That is something I think all the pioneers who brought Buddhism to Japan and started these communities had on their mind. So, and I think this 100th anniversary, now at least we made it to the first 100 years. So they're talking about this 500 year vision, and they're really keen. So it's a lot is unknown, but I think it's a wonderful time. To be, that's so. I'm very yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Anyone on Zoom? Who would like to ask? How do you see Sotoshu relationship to like a small sangha like ours, and how would you like it to see that develop?
Oh, I shared this with actually Kate and Michael. There's an interesting relationship, oh gosh, I should be laughing about this, of Sotoshu, which also comes with a particular cultural difference. Here we are in the West, really democratic, really kind of sensitive to human suffering. I mean, it's how it should be. But established tradition in Japan. There's a lot of misunderstanding. There has been a lot of kind of love-hate relationships. I work, one of my 2 feet, 1 foot is my Sotoshu side, but I also serve the North American community. So the other foot is on the North American side, especially Canada. It's, I look at it differently, but it's especially. To be honest, I think they don't really know. That's my impression. And they don't really know what to expect. But they understand that it's a wonderful thing, is Dharma is spreading. I don't think they have a clear understanding in terms of how, as an organization, we want to be connected. But all that I can see is they want to sort of have a Dharma connection. In case of Japan, we honor Dogen Zenji as a symbol of a father-like symbol of integrity of Soto Zen practice, and Keizan Zenji as a symbol of diversity, embracing quality, which allows all community sanghas to be uniquely different. So I always see this as a vertical line, a horizontal line of Soto Zen. And so there, I think the looking forward sort of a way to just kind of stay connected, to maintain this value together. And even for me being involved in this whole process, organizational process, I am not really sure how it goes. And I think that's the most fun part of it. And you probably can understand us, and only the history will tell. That's my understanding. Sorry, I'm not answering your questions, but yes.
I have a more a comment. I was interested that at the ceremony, the 100th year one, all the chants were done just in English and not in Japanese. You said that, right?
Most, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm just curious about how you see that use of language, as in bringing the tradition from Japan to North America, where English is the main language, but you still want to keep connection with, you know, the ancestors, the traditions that,
right,
that we come from. And there's, I think, something is lost in translation sometimes, and something is gained.
Oh, thank you. Yes. So this Jukai, you intentionally did the chanting in English. It was really intentional. All the explanations were provided in English, and there were some Japanese American community members are there. For example, Sokoji Temple, where Suzuki Roshi served first, were together with San Francisco Zen teachers like Vicky. They were all there together. They offered incense for Shinji Suzuki Roshi together. Actually, San Francisco people encouraged Sokoji members to go forward. It was really touching to me. This was just what we did. And to be honest, there was also a response there. Even the question of what does it mean to be a global Soto Zen? What does it even mean to be fully universal Soto Zen? And does that mean translating everything into English? Is that the answer? Just for this Jukai, we did this in English. Just to just kind of clarify how we want to direct our organization to. And yet, there's this more profound question. What does it even mean to be truly global? And everybody has different views. And as fellow Canadians, I would like to ask that question. And I think some would say maintaining the sound, the original Pali, Sanskrit, Chinese, Japanese. Is that the way to go to be truly global? Or translating into all different languages? Is that the way to go? So it's an open question for everyone. And I think Think Soto Shu is saying that's the answer. That was just an expression for this occasion. So thank you. Yes.
A Zoom question?
Thank you so much for coming and speaking to us this evening.
Oh, thank you.
You just talked about global Soto Zen, and yes, that such a thing is possible. And we also know that as Buddhism has moved through the world, it's morphed and changed, and different emphases, etc. You're in an interesting position because you are steeped, obviously, and grew up in and have practiced deeply in Japanese Soto Zen, and then now you've been in North America for a time. And as you, on this 100th anniversary, when you look at North American Soto Zen practice, what does anything strike you as perhaps an emerging sort of quality or characteristic or a feature of North American Buddhism that seems to distinguish it in some ways from types in Japan. Apart from, obviously, in Japan, it's, you know, there's the whole traditional, the tradition, etc. But I guess what I'm really talking about is the emphasis or the spirit, if I describe such a thing. I know it's a rather abstract concept, perhaps like the flavor that you're describing, but I wonder if you've gotten any tastes of that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I think bottom line is, I love it. especially in San Francisco, the Branching Stream, I always kind of feel this warmth, sincerity, let me put it this way. It's always there, always. Inquisitiveness, not afraid to ask questions. People care. I'm aware of criticism that comes from West to Japanese Sotoshu. And that's because those are precisely the questions I had myself, struggled myself. The most painful thing of all that I experienced in my home country was indifference. That indifference was the hardest to handle. Yet, we were bearing this on our shoulders to continue. People care here, and they practice. And of course, because people care, there's sometimes disagreement and conflict, which is another matter, I think. And yet, authenticity is the word. I talked about with Konjin Gotwin and Honshu when we just happened to be together. The definition of authenticity, I think that's where the difference is. And it's a bit hard to share this with my friends in Japan. Definition of authenticity. That's the thing that we talked about briefly. And that's something that I want to share. I think it requires some skillful means to share this with Japanese. And there's this great things, great teachings and qualities in Japanese Sotoshu too. But it also needs some skillful means to really, I don't know, extract is a word to share, but to kind of share this. But that's where my basic motive is coming from for this. So not sure if that answered your questions. Thank you.
So thank you.
Okay.
So much.
Thank you.
Yoke-sensei, I think we need to close for the evening. So.